Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello and welcome to the Red Box Politics podcast on The Times. I'm Matt Chorley. This is part two in our four-part series on politics and comedy, speaking to the people who write jokes about politicians and for them. I'm delighted to be joined by comedian Andy Zaltzman, who way back under Gladstone, I think, started podcasting for The Times with The Bugle, with John Oliver. We're also joined by Tiff Stevenson, who you'll know from shows like People Just Do Nothing and Mock the Week, and is a creator of the brilliant Bridget Trump's Diary Twitter account. We'll talk about that in a minute. And we've also got The Times' very own Hugo Rifkin, who not only writes a weekly column and leaders for the paper, but also writes the My Week parody every week and is a regular on the Radio 4's News Quiz. Welcome to you all.
Hello.
Hello.
And welcome back to you, Andy.
Yeah, it's nice change around here. This is a completely different building, very disorienting. I remember when all this was fields. London Bridge.
Well, it's nice to have you back. Now, let's. The reason for talking about this is the original conception of this was last year, at a time when post Brexit and Donald Trump, we were very anxious. And was all of this too serious to be funny about? It feels like Donald Trump has answered that question, and actually, no, things are. He's perfectly mockable. But I'll start with you, Andy. How do you approach talking about politics and comedy?
Well, I mean, firstly, it has to be funny. So, that is a rule number one of political comedy, I think. It needs to be funny above all else. And then, you know, if you've got any message you're trying to preach to your almost certainly converted audience, that comes second. With Brexit and Trump, because so many people are doing comedy about it, both through what you might call mainstream or high profile comedy and just random stuff on the internet, you know, there's 7 billion people cracking jokes about Trump. The challenge is to find an original, distinctive angle, which can be quite difficult given the sheer volume of stuff generated by and about Trump.
Yeah. And Tiff, is the motivation of doing comedy about politics because you're just interested in it and so that's what you want to make jokes about? Or is it about sort of changing people's opinions or making a point? What's more important? Is it the jokes or the making the point?
The jokes are always important. Andy's right. It has to be funny first and foremost, but I sort of work from my gut. A lot of my stuff sort of comes from anger or perceived injustice, especially with Trump as a woman. I'm not saying it's worse, but I think
I've not tried him as a woman, but I mean, quite bad as a man, but it seems to be worse.
He's the worst woman you could ever imagine. From my point of view, I mean, I've always sort of done a mix of social, sort of socio-political, personal, and, you know, and I guess politics has come to the fore more in the last couple of years because We're living in a strange time where, you know, subtlety and nuance has gone out of debate and conversation. And I think at this point, the sort of left are almost as bad as the right for the inability to be able to have like a nuanced, detailed sort of debate. So you're sort of left in the middle going, guys, seriously, can we just, you know... So in terms of preaching to the converted and stuff, I quite like when people who disagree with me politically come along to shows. I've had a couple of tour shows recently where someone sort of tweeted me afterwards saying politically we're not aligned at all, but I really enjoyed the show. And I guess that's the point, is that we can kind of put each other's side across and have an interesting debate. But at the moment, it just seems to be whoever's screaming the loudest, like Piers Morgan getting owned on Bill Mayer's show, and I was like, well, he basically got told to f off by Jim Jefferies, you know, which I don't think is owning someone. I think if you're going to own someone, you need to pull apart their ideology and challenge what they're saying.
You don't want to own Piers Morgan either. That's basically, you want to rent him.
No. For half an hour. do you even want to do that?
Not sure.
Yeah, lease Piers Morgan. So I'm sort of coming at it really from a place of frustration. I feel like as a woman, you know, we're sort of fighting to gain equality in all of these areas, and then someone who is the pinnacle of sort of misogyny. I was in America and I was sort of mocking them about Trump, and then I felt bad because I was like, well, you know, Brexit happened, and it's like America looked at that and went, we can supersize that. Or just, you know, so I come at it from the gut. I do think there is a point in doing it. I do think if you can try and make people think a bit differently, although that's not the first aim of comedy, it is laughter. But I do like to challenge people. I don't want people to come along to my shows and agree with everything. I want them to be challenged. I want them to think about things in a different way. And so I think that comedy is good for pricking the bubble of the powerful. And we know how much Donald Trump hates being mocked, which kind of is encouraging to think that you should do it more and more.
Hugo, you've written in the Times recently about how you were a fan of satire, but you weren't convinced that, you know, people shouldn't get carried away in thinking it changes anything.
I think there's a complacency that sets in when everyone you know is laughing at somebody for being an idiot, and you think, well, that's just obvious. This one's settled. But I mean, Trump's interesting. Trump's really, really difficult to parody. I'm not sure if I can say this in a non-dodgy way, so you might need to take it out. But there's this theory in religious Islam, right, that the Quran itself is a miracle because nobody can write like the Quran is written. And Trump's speech patterns are a bit like that. And when you try and copy them, it's really difficult to do. And it's really difficult to do with the economy of language that he uses. And you find yourself rabbiting on, not really having space to put the joke in. It's really, really hard to do. The point of satire and where it differs from comedy, I think, is that it does need to have a point. It has to have a bite. It has to change minds. It has to, in some sort of way, perhaps say the unsayable, hiding behind comedy to say the unsayable. That's really, really difficult to do with Trump because for him, nothing is unsayable. There are almost no words you can put into his mouth that you can't imagine him saying. And that people will believe and will agree with. Trump's difficult to parody for the same reason that he thrives on alternative facts and fake news. In a way, comedy is alternative fact. You know, comedy is pretending someone said something that they haven't in order to laugh at them. And when you do this with Trump, people just believe you. I mean, when I wrote this big piece about fake news at the weekend, and one of the major sources of fake news infecting the internet is satire that people don't get, because almost nothing you write about American politics these days is unbelievable.
And I can't remember who it wasn't Donald Trump, but somebody that you wrote in your My Week column, yeah, was imagining the week's diary of somebody who'd been in the news that week. Proper politician actually thought it was genuine.
I did Zach Goldsmith's diary, and Jon Snow.
That's right, Jon Snow
thought it was genuine. But I mean, this has happened before. I did one of Jerry Halliwell, which ended up in Sood's Corner in Private Eye from the mouth of Jerry Halliwell, which I felt quite bad. But that's again, that's tricky because on one level, well, that's brilliant satire because it fooled a journalist. But then, is it satire? Does that just mean it wasn't funny enough? Does that mean I was just lying instead of joking? You know, I'm not sure.
You just wrote a sort of convincing Zach Goldsmith script.
The Onion headlines and sort of Breitbart sort of headlines sort of collide into these, and you can't tell what's real anymore. I saw a story yesterday in, I think it was Orlando Weekly, and I was like, is that a real publication about a woman saying, if we have like mixed gender toilets, I'm taking my gun in as my bodyguard? And I was like, no one said that in real life. Like, that cannot possibly be true.
But it can.
And it was. Yeah. It can and it will be. So you do kind of... you do get to a point, having done two shows where Trump featured sort of quite heavily in them, that you get to a point of going, okay, I'm running out of ways to satirise him. And that's why I sort of created Bridget Trump.
So let's talk about this. This is Bridget Trump's diary.
Yeah.
Which is a Twitter account that you do.
Yeah.
And it's things that Donald Trump would have said, but in the style of Bridget Jones.
Yeah, Bridget Trump is sort of, I think it was at the beginning of this year, I was looking at his tweets and it was pre-inauguration. And one of them said, going to meet with Condé Nast and Anna Wintour in the AM, V excited. And I was like, this is less presidential and more just like Bridget Jones. And he tweets like a 32-year-old saddo singleton in London. And then I just experimented with a couple. And it's, again, this is the thing about it. It's remarkable how little you have to change, you know. In the Bridget Trump universe, I don't bring any of the family because I talk about his wife in my stand-up, but I don't bring any of the family in. He is very much exists. All of his love interests and friends are political ones. So you've got Putin as the Daniel Cleaver character and then Nigel Farage as Mark Darcy.
So this is one. Nigel, who likes me, quotes, just the way I am, came for dinner last night. I ordered blue soup and we played footsie under the table. Am sex goddess.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
which is a horrible mental image between...
Well, they love John words. They love an exclamation point, and they love words like huge, huge. But
the way he tweets is sort of teenage girl's diary.
Yeah, and I think that's where the original. I went back through my timeline on Twitter, and it was a couple of years ago. I was like, maybe they'll like me now if I dye my skin orange. Maybe they'll like me if I change my hair. And I sort of done that. Was obviously the genesis of the idea. But yeah, I mean, but the good thing about doing this is it means that you can tweet within the world of it. So, you know, when he was at, is it Mar-a-Lago? Which is, you know, again, you're kind of going, oh, that's where it's normally Camp David.
Camp David, yeah.
Where those kind of meetings would take place, where he's now just going, let's just throw some money into my tourism business. But I was able to say, have gone away on official full-blown mini break with Japanese sex god.
Well, that, dinner when he had the Japanese prime minister was like a scene from a not very good sitcom where he was having sort of security briefings while hapless waiters bumbled around in the background carrying soup.
Yeah.
And people took photos and, you know.
This is exactly it. The way you'd mock somebody like Trump is you'd go, right, he's pretending to be president, but he's devoted to his business interests. So the sort of thing you can't quite allege that sort of openly. So you'd write some satirical thing where he's got the Japanese prime minister with him and he conducts a business meeting in front of paying guests at his own hotel. Oh.
With hilarious consequences. Yeah.
I want him to become the first president to declare war whilst going down a water slide.
Which he owns.
Yes.
Yeah, yeah.
I've started calling him Impeachy Keen. As I'm hoping it will happen.
So what about the Alec Baldwin impression of him? Because it's sort of, there's this theory that Donald Trump is, you know, he promised to boost old American industries, and he certainly boosted Saturday Night Live and Alec Baldwin's impression of him. Is there a point where that will stop being funny because it's you're trying to send up the unsend-upable? Is it still working?
Whether it's clearly, I think Trump's going to remain absurd for as long as he's both alive and dead, so that's basically forever.
Schrodinger's Trump.
So I guess there will always be a market for people who want to see that lampooned. I guess longer term, the more serious stuff and the stuff that I guess, you know, satirical comedy will want to address is what he's actually doing rather than just the things he's saying,
just the way he says them. So it moves beyond the sort of George W. Bush mocking of just he's a bit thick and he says dopey things.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And then at that, you know, you have more journalistic satire. Like, yeah, there's a lot of in America with the, you know, the Daily Show and John Oliver Show and other stuff. So, clearly that people love that. I mean, also, Trump is going to remain divisive, so there's always going to be a massive number of people who just like to see his idiocy
played out and
lampooned. So, I think there's always going to be a market for Trump caricature.
I do like the idea of women doing it as well. I love Melissa McCarthy's sort of Sean Spicer was great. And I think that is quite, because Alec Baldwin's is brilliant, but it's quite sort of spot on and obviously infuriates Trump. But I think he was more infuriated by the idea that Sean Spicer could be played by a woman. I think Bridget Trump would be, this is really insulting to me because I'm such a alpha.
A Muslim Trump.
They were going to get Rosie O'Donnell to do it, weren't they? I heard, which would be... But I mean, that's like the holy grail of this kind of sort of political satire. When you want it to draw blood, is that you create a portrayal of someone or an image of someone that doesn't just make the people who already want to laugh at them laugh, but also gets into, like a worm, gets into the minds of even his supporters.
Yeah.
So like Melissa McCarthy's what's his name, Sean Spicer. It's done that. It has replaced
him. You can't
watch it. Can't look at him without seeing that.
It's sort of amazing that an American actress doing an impression of the very newly appointed White House spokesman has become a sort of global phenomenon. And now people, to the point that people in the UK, as well as in America, now can't look at the real Sean Spicer without thinking at any moment his podium is going to
start
moving across the room.
I mean, people did it. People did it with, well, in this country anyway, people did it with, Bremner did it with Blair pretty much. You couldn't watch Blair without hearing Bremner. What's his name? The guy in Dead Ringers did it with Bush.
John Coulter
did it up to an extent with Bush. So it can be done. But you're right, for it to happen this quickly and this globally is.
I think because it has to go beyond an impression. Yeah. It can't just be like the writing underpinning it.
Yeah.
Like I'm not saying it's easy to do voices, but like. To actually do an accurate impression is different to saying something or writing truly original. And that was why I think the Sean Spicer thing landed so much, because it took the ridiculousness of him and just played it up, explaining it with the toys, the Segway podium, of just like kind of amping it up, and the huge packet of Orbit cinnamon chewing gum, and that's all real stuff, but just heightened. He goes through like what, 10 packets a day or something. He's spoken to his doctor
and he can swallow it. So what about then, because we've talked a lot about Trump, I think partly because it's such a massive colourful comedy jamboree, while in the UK we've got Theresa May. Are there jokes to be had as a comedian with Theresa May?
What I love with my well, particularly when I write my My Week column and I look at the Conservatives, what I like doing, in a way, it's the most journalistic that column ever is, because I speak to my political reporting colleagues, and the things they tell me that aren't quite getting written about, not for any particular dark reason, just because they're not quite the story yet, I try and put in. So I put in things about the way her chiefs of staff are known to bully everybody. I put in things about the tensions in the cabinet that are known to be there between Philip Hammond and her and Liam Fox and people. And you try and really draw them out. So you are... explaining is wrong, but presenting a plausible dynamic
and
of what the situation
learning,
actually
people
is.
People learn something about what's really going on.
That's
underneath.
The hope. Yeah, it's not just a laugh. Yeah. It should be funny, but it should be more than funny.
Is there comedy in Theresa May?
There is, and I think there's a lot of... I mean, there was parallels in the election in sort of, in the coverage. A lot of the stuff that I talk about within UK politics is how women are spoken about in the coverage, female politicians versus male politicians. And it happens in American politics as well. But I mean, even here, like, I think it was like 6 weeks before the election, Grazia ran a headline going, "Does Hillary need to up her fashion game?" I was like, maybe her email password game. I literally couldn't believe that I was reading this. I was like, is this still the conversation? So, that's the kind of stuff I like to unpick. I like to look at how stuff is being covered and then go, oh, look at this. And going, okay, fine. If we're going to continue with this line of like making it womb bothering female politicians as well, to the point that Nicola Sturgeon has to come out and go, I had a miscarriage, like, leave me alone. It's about my ability to do the job. So
that was such a big issue that actually decided who the Prime Minister was. It was Andrea Leadsom.
An
interview with The Times,
her
talking about
having
children.
Theresa May and her are sort of on opposite sides of the, you don't have a real stake in the future of the UK. And then Theresa May sort of campaigning to lower abortion limits, it's like... they're both womb botherers in different ways. One is kind of like restricting your reproductive rights, and the other is kind of going, well, you're not as good a woman if you don't have children. And so those are the kind of, you can kind of get into the feminism of it. In my show, I sort of I defend Theresa May as a woman and her coverage, but I disagree with her policies. And I'm like, you know, and the reason I can do that is because I don't have to agree with everything every woman has ever said, you know.
That's
not what feminism is. Everyone knows it's hating men. And then but those are the sort of things, there's so much to tuck into. There's so much, I mean, there's so much classism within our politics that I feel is not necessarily the same in America. And then characters like Philip Davis, I mean, you have to, he's almost unbelievable.
He's like, so Philip Davis, a toy backbench MP who's makes it a sort of personal mission to talk out backbench laws.
Filibustering.
He thinks there should be an International Men's Day. He does sound like, as a character, that...
There is an International Men's Day.
Yeah.
It's every day.
There is one. I mean, he is like, almost like a character out of like Viz magazine. Is it Sid the Sexist that they used to have in Viz magazine? He's literally like...
Sid the Sexist MP.
He's so ridiculous. And I know that like kind of Jess Phillips sort of gets into it with him and... the other day I was saying we should have a sitcom, we'll call it 2.5 Meninists, and it would be him and Piers Morgan and maybe someone like Mel Gibson, like all sharing a flat together. You know, I could see that as a sketch. Maybe I should just write the sketch, but I could see that as a spoofy, you know.
I could see that as a documentary.
But yeah, there's plenty to get angry about, and there's plenty to, you know, especially with all the women's rights stuff in America at the moment, with all the repeal the eighth stuff that's going on here. Like, people don't realise that this is happening on our own doorstep. There's women that still don't have access to safe, you know, sort of you know, abortions and terminations. So that there's a lot to be said, and I'm almost trying to move away from Brexit, I guess, because of the easy divisive kind of arguments that people make around it, but getting into other bits of legislation.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
And Andy, Jeremy Corbyn, is it still okay to make jokes about him, or is that just like kicking a puppy?
I mean, so, you know, I guess it depends on your view of dog welfare. I mean, it's clearly always, you know, anyone in a position of power is a suitable target for...
But we're talking about Jeremy Corbyn, people in a position of power.
If I can just pick up on the Theresa May thing, I think one of the interesting things about Theresa May from a comedic point of view is the sense that she's basically just riffing out an entire prime ministership. It's kind of improv politics. So it just kind of happened and no one was quite expecting it, and then, you know, everyone's just winging it. So there's, I think, some interesting angles to come out of that. With Corbyn, well, again, I guess what you might call the deeper satire is about what is happening to the whole of the left wing politically in Britain. I think there's elements where clearly the Labour Party should have split, I think. Our electoral system set up to basically prevent democratic evolution. Because if they split, then they'd have half the number of seats each.
Yeah.
So, again, you sort of, I think, need to go beyond the individual personalities to get to what they might, you know, what they represent or what they're revealing. Which I think, I mean, it's a very strange and very fluid politics that we have at the moment. So I think the more interesting stuff is not necessarily, you know, just lampooning the individual.
Yeah, yeah, because looking at politics, small p politics, and where people are on that.
That's the socio-political thing as well. It's exactly that, where you feel like the left is kind of, I almost feel like it's disappearing. Yeah. Like there is no left.
Yeah.
They would rename that film with Daniel Day-Lewis, My Right Foot. just it's sort of disintegrate. There's no cohesion between what people are trying to achieve,
This is why Corbyn's interesting and great. I mean, he's great for satire for two reasons. But I mean, as an individual, he's perfect. He has that massive disparity between the outer image and the turmoil inside. You know, he does not see himself how anybody else alive sees him.
Yeah, yeah.
And so you can always get into that crack there. But also, he is what comedy, particularly in Britain, is not great at is mocking the left. Because most comedians are on the left in some way, and humour takes you to the left because you wish to mock institutions and you want to, and there's a certain kind of power that's easier to take the piss out of, which tends to be found on the right. But there is an enormous amount of, you know, sort of piety and self-satisfaction and unthinking blindness on the left. And the wonderful thing about Corbyn is he absolutely is solidly there representing every last bit of it, and so are the people around him.
But he is like a sort of tedious 1980s left-wing comedian who's got no jokes, but
yes,
he just
exactly.
believes in this sort of ideal.
Yeah, I mean, the humorlessness of the left, which is so funny when you can find it, he just embodies. It's brilliant.
The one thing, because I'm conscious we are running out of time, I wanted to touch on whether there was a sort of political, what is popular in politics, whether that splits. And Hugh and I have a shared view of Mrs Brown's Boys. Which I just think is one of the worst things on television. And yet there's this sort of school of thought that if you say that, then you're sort of metropolitan elite. You don't get it because it's the biggest watched thing at Christmas.
I'm disappointed you said one of. I'm wondering what else you're going to put there with it if it's only one of the worst things on television.
Well, that's probably a whole new podcast of what's worse than Mrs. Brown's Boys. So I know you're not a fan.
Yeah.
But is this a class thing? Is it a political thing? People have said, you know, Mrs. Brown's Boys is Brexit Britain.
I think there is a little bit of classism in there. Personally, like the idea of like just dressing as a woman or femaleness being hilarious is a problem that we've had for years in Britain. You know, like it's just the idea that a man puts a dress on is automatically hysterical.
Doesn't work for me at my gigs too.
Oh, even when you put a bow in your hair. Yeah.
Is it not funny because it's got inbuilt sort of
I think there's part of
it. Was it because it was something that was funny 30, 40, 50 years ago?
I watched the film and I
found a film.
Yeah, there was a film. It was on at Christmas and I did enjoy. There was parts of it I really, really enjoyed. There was parts of it where I was
cut
like
you out of this entire podcast.
No, there was parts of it where I was like, I'm not sure that's cool to have that kind of bit of. There was like a karate teacher, but like he was from was not. Yeah, so I was like that. But there was parts of it where I felt like it was sort of heartfelt, sort of working class voice. And I think because it's different to what I do, I don't want to just immediately decimate it and say that it doesn't have value. Because for a lot of people, it does have value.
Do screw them. It's awful. I mean, it's the problem. The problem with Mrs. Brown's Boys is not that it's offensive, right? Borat's offensive, but hilarious. You know, there's this lie that gets told that you can't be offensive in comedy anymore. That's rubbish. There's loads of really, really funny, offensive comedy. My problem with Mrs. Brown's Boys, without being getting sort of too pious about it, is it's not inventive, it's not thoughtful, it's mind-numbing. And you sort of think, everyone could just be watching something else that's better.
Yes, well, I think when that could apply across not just comedy, but you know, a lot of
just telly.
I mean, I've never actually seen it, so I can't really. But I think, I mean, the thing is, you can get accused of being a metropolitan elite by doing pretty much anything now, from you know, breathing to you know, eating a sandwich.
Having been to that there, London.
Yes. But I mean, comedy is it's a broad art form, so I think there's room for. You know, if people like it.
And loads of people like it.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's not just...
And, as we've found, and I think there's, in politics, there's this whole argument going on at the moment about Brexit, and the Brexiteers say Remainers have just got to shut up. The Remainers saying, just because you won doesn't mean I have to change my view, I can carry on having this view. And just because I don't like Mrs. Brown's Boys, per se, I think people who watch it are clearly mad, but that's up to them. But I'm not wrong for saying that I don't like it. Opinion is opinion, and politics is essentially different strands of opinion. Just because Hugo touched on it slightly, is there anything which you wouldn't touch in comedy in terms of subjects that you that were either too offensive or too divisive, or are there no-go areas?
No, I don't think there's no-go areas, but it's all about how you treat the subject and what you're attempting to achieve with it. So I don't think there are any areas that comedians should not address, but you have to be aware that some areas are more sensitive than others. So you'd have to be fairly idiotic not to be aware of that. Sometimes you might think, right, well, I need to do this in a certain way because this piece of material is not intended to offend, it's intended to, make people laugh, make a point, whatever. But if you're unaware that some people might take offence, then that's your own fault, really. But also at the same time, I think, sometimes you need to just accept that. You need to think, well, I'm going to do this because it's what I think, what I believe, what I think is funny. And if people get offended by it, then, you can accept that. And as long as your material is, if you've thought about it and you know what you're trying to achieve with it, if people get offended by it, then that's just one of the inevitable byproducts of it.
And does it change what provokes offence? There's been a lot of debate about the sort of snowflake generation, particularly in universities, the idea of banning people that you don't agree with and all that sort of stuff. Is that something you're sort of conscious of Tiff, of what is and isn't acceptable?
I try and think, I totally agree with what Andy says. I mean, it's either all on the table or none of it's on the table. I think, anything can be joked about. It's the right way. It's what your intent is behind it. I try and go, when I go to sleep and I put my head down on the pillow at night, do I feel okay about what I've put out into the world? Can it be, and what my intention for it is? And there was a great interview with George Carlin once. It was on a late night cable thing. And the interviewer said to him, oh, people describe you as a shock comic. Does that upset you? And he was like, no, shock is just another form of surprise, which all comedy is based on. So I think I really like sometimes getting a, I can't quite believe she said that. And then I'll go now. And then sometimes it's quite fun to unpack that reaction. Go, why were you so shocked by what I just said there? And then you can unpick it. And I like those bits of comedy. I like going into those little corners that might be a little bit, if you've got a dark corner, throwing some light on it helps people to be able to talk about things that would normally, especially around the Bill Cosby thing, people were like, is this appropriate? And it's like, if you don't talk about it, that makes it much easier to sweep under the carpet and cover up and have this conspiracy of silence around something really awful. So I think comedy's great for just blowing that away and getting people to engage with it. Now, obviously, there are situations that people might be more sensitive about. I also think this life, there's stuff that I might be more sensitive about, but also I am aware that that's my own, like you say, offence is very, very personal. And I think when you're talking about really sensitive things, it's how good a comedian you are.
Yeah.
Because a bad comedian or a new comedian would come in and talk about rape and make a joke like they're a rapist. Whereas another person would be doing, as long as the victim is not the butt of the joke, then that's where the angle is, And so I think it's about knowing how to, it's being a good comedian, really.
Yeah. And in terms of the snowflake generation, everyone is a snowflake on all sides of the political spectrum, as far as I can work out.
Oh, Donald Trump's the most sensitive,
So, snowflakes to the left of me, snowflakes to the right of me. And I think part of that is just the nature of the internet, that everything is, heightened emotionally and politically.
Sometimes we just need to turn Twitter off and go.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think we also need to sort of draw a bit of a line between where people get overly upset because someone's said something that's not quite right, that's not quite fully right on, and this is the problem in the left, that you kind of go, okay, all right, well, it's not, we just need to be able to discuss it and go, do you think maybe you could say something this way and not make it this kind of huge, just to be able to talk to each other, and everyone makes mistakes and that's how we learn and that's how we grow.
And also one of the problems from a comedic point of view is that, a sentence from a comedy set taken out of context can look horribly offensive and intolerant. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Whereas, when seen in the context of an entire routine, it's the absolute opposite of what it might look like on paper.
Well, I know in my dim and distant past, when I was in a comedy group there were lines that I uttered on stage at Edinburgh or whatever, which if taken out of context now would be, would be surprised. But anyway, that's an entirely different story. Thank you so much. I feel like we've covered quite a lot of ground there. Before we go, we've obviously got to get the compulsory plugs in. Tiff, first of all, what's the Twitter handle for Bridget Trump's diary?
It's it's at Bridget Trump's D1.
Very good.
And at Tiff Stevenson is mine.
And your website, if you want to come and see you touring and things like that?
TiffStevenson.co.uk.
And Andy?
Yeah, well, the Bugle's back away from the Times independently. So
but still
you can
going,
find that.
But still, you know.
Yes, no John Oliver anymore, because he's...
if anything, it's better now, I think.
Well, he's...
I think, you know, he's gone off wherever he's gone.
Things aren't going too well for him. He's had to settle down and get a regular 9-to-5. So,
and your website for people who want to come and see you live?
That's andyzaltzman.co.uk, and the Bugle is thebuglepodcast.com.
Very good. And as ever, you can sign up to the Redbox... While we're on the subject of plugs, you can sign up to my morning email briefing at thetimes.co.uk/redbox, and you can subscribe to the podcast on iTunes, where we'd love it if you left a review. But for now, from me, Andy, Tiff and Hugo, it's goodbye.
Thank you for downloading. To discover more, head to thetimes.co.uk.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Manveen Rana from The Story, a daily news podcast from The Times. Join me and my co-host Luke Jones for a deep dive into the big stories and investigations. Plus, each month, William Hague hosts an agenda-setting interview with a key newsmaker or big thinker. That's The Story, The Times' daily podcast that brings you one remarkable story told in depth. Listen every weekday on the Times Radio app or wherever you get your podcasts.